Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard. I am the aforementioned host, Sal, and along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And it's just a quick reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. And you can click onto the chat room with the usual suspects. If in the course of the show you have some observations or questions that you would like for Eagle One or myself to ask, or if you think we're missing a big point of the issue, go ahead and fold it into the chat room. Both Eagle One and I will be there. We'll grab it, and we'll try to fold it in as best as we can. And if you're new to Midrats, or if you only catch halfway through the show, you can always go over to the show page at Blog Talk Radio and pick up the archive, or if you prefer to listen on your own terms, you can get the free podcast over on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. We've done a few shows in the past on this topic, and we figured it was time to reach it again. And the problem with piracy, it really isn't going each year. It's not going anywhere. It continues to grow, expand, and evolve. And in many places, for instance, in Somalia, it's becoming an integral part of the local economy. We have non-governed areas all throughout the world that seem to be picking up some of the habits to the point that it's beginning to threaten the free flow of goods at market prices through our sea lines of communication. And for the full hour today to discuss, we're going to have as our guest Rear Admiral Terry McKnight, USN retired. He's a former commander of Anti-Piracy Task Force 151 off the Horn of Africa. Admiral McKnight, welcome to Midrats.
Welcome, and thanks for having us today. It's a real pleasure to talk about one of my favorite subjects, piracy. Still intimately involved with the issues. I'm working on a book called Pirate Alley, and I look forward to the discussion today.
Yes, sir, and we really appreciate you taking time this Sunday afternoon to flesh it out some more. I think the interesting thing is I'm just a young kid of 45 years old, and my generation and a few others, plus or minus 10 years, you know, growing up, when you thought of piracy, you thought of Errol Flynn, or if you're lucky enough to me to live within striking distance of one of the Disney locations, it was a ride at Disney World that you went on three or four times. But here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and piracy is a very serious problem. Why now, and why does it seem to have such resilience?
Well, it just, you know, it's kind of picked up. In 2005, we saw a real increase in the numbers in piracy. 2008 was probably the monumental year when the European Union and everybody started to set up a task force to go out there and fight piracy. Back before 2008, basically, you had 30,000 ships that transit through the Gulf of Aden, spread all over the ocean in the Gulf, and pirates, it was just like the Wild Wild West. They got them set up in what we call the internationally recognized transit corridor, which is an east-west highway, which helped out a lot. And then the European Union got out there in late 2008. I got a call from Admiral Gortney, who was the 5th Fleet commander in 2008. He said, pack your bags. You're going to go out here and start up Task Force 151, which we started up in January 2009. In 2009, it was still very, very big. 2010, the numbers were off the chart. 2011, it slowed down a bit. And in 2012, it's about this time of year. And if you're not familiar with piracy in the Gulf of Aden, it's a seasonal sport. In the summertime, when the monsoons are out there, heavy rains, heavy winds, the pirates basically stay home. But this time of year, the weather is just perfect out there, and the seas are calm, and piracy tends to pick up. The late early winter, late winter, and then into the spring. So I think that we'll see some major events here in the coming weeks.
Eagle One, you there?
Out of the I'm here. Admiral, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Well, it looks like we're having a little bit of audio problems there with Eagle One. So, Elric, now let me go ahead and pick up that thread and pull on it a bit. The back, I guess this is probably the late 2005, early 2006, over in the online world, there was a blogger who used to run a place called the Politburo Diktat. And he brought up when piracy really started to break above the background noise over in Indonesia, and it started off with Somalia, and he asked, where was the Navy? And I know that my co-host, on the online world at least, he was one of the first people to really start picking up this issue. And I kind of hooked those two together, and that really started a lot of the conversation about it. And we saw that evolution where a lot of the interest in piracy took place in the Malaysia, Indonesian area, and then it shifted over to Somalia, the Horn of Africa, and we're now starting to see it in other places in Africa. Is this a combination of economic issues in ungoverned areas? I mean, bad economic problems in ungoverned areas is really nothing new. It's been around for a very long time. Or is this a different combination of economic models, opportunity, and a few other things that is causing this to spread? And when we go back to the beginning, when we first started breaking above the background noise in Indonesia and Malaysia, we don't hear as much out of that area as well. Has something happened there, or is the Horn of Africa just more important?
Excellent question. So let me talk about Indonesia first. One thing, we had the tsunami that went through there, and unfortunately, a lot of the fishing fleets and the boats that we were using for piracy got wiped out in the tsunami. So that was one factor. The other factor, which is very important, though, is the nations got together out there and said, hey, look, we're not going to tolerate this. So with they bought some small patrol boats, Coast Guard-type cutters, not big ships, and basically took control and law enforcement in their own hands. It still happens out there, but you don't see the numbers as you did in years past. Now let's shift to the Gulf of Aden. I think all of us are well familiar. Somalia is a failed state. It continues to be a failed state. And I mean, no matter how we talk about it, the symptoms, the solutions for piracy, the answer to it is a sure. But we're not quite there yet. And I'm not sure how we're going to get there. We have made some steps, but it's a long way. So basically what happened, there's a lot of tales. When I go out there and speak about piracy, I use the tale that basically that you had fishing vessels coming into the waters off Somalia, you know, from foreign nations all over the world, and basically depleting the fishing stocks out there. And these people said, okay, we're going to take matters into our own hand. We're going to stay. They said we're going to be our own Coast Guard, but they were pirates, and basically went out there and started hijacking fishing vessels. And they were getting small sums. Navies were out there. The U.S. Navy's been out there. There's a couple cases that we could. I remember Winston Churchill. They captured some pirates, but it was just hit and miss. It was small fishing vessels. And it just didn't reach the magnitude of a national security issue. So let's fast forward. These guys, a few years, 2007, 2008, the light came on and they said, hey, if I can get $50,000 for a fishing vessel, why don't I go after some bigger fish? And that's what they did, is they actually went after some larger ships. The first ship that in 2007 was the Danica White, which got a ransom for over $1 million. So that was the first step, and they said, okay, this is a money business, and we're going out there. A couple things that changed in I was out there in 2007. We had a motor vessel called the Golden Nori. that was hijacked. It was carrying a load of benzene. And the word was, and it was the fear that they were going to use this as a terrorist weapon, that possibly that the pirates would, you know, ransom this and give it to al-Shabaab, whoever was out there, and use it as a terrorist weapon. Well, that never materialized. But basically, we got permission from the transitional government there in Somalia to basically play man-to-man defense on Golden Nori. Eventually, she was released. And actually, I was out there twice, like I said, in 2008, in January, when I left Bahrain, there were no ships pirated. Well, after a little couple months later, it started to pick up again, and the ransom started to pick up, and it basically became as in 2010, it was the Harvard Business School business model for running a business in piracy, and it became very lucrative. Last year, in 2011, the cost, you know, people are saying it, the cost of $7 billion. Some people will say, you know, if you have a world economy of, $60 trillion, that's just a drop in the bucket. But it still hinders the flow of commerce, and the navies are out there. They're out there in force. One of the great things that I always talk about it is the coalitions that are out there. There's a different task force. The Russians are out there. The Chinese are out there. The 151 is out there. European Union. And they're all out there working together. And, I mean, this is a great model. And the other thing that is very beneficial, we've had a couple UN security resolutions that have allowed us the tools and gave us permissions to go out after the pirates. So we can go inside of their territorial waters to chase them. And if somebody decides to go in and chase the pirates, as we've seen on a couple cases, that we have the UN Security Council's permission to go there and go after the pirates. So I wrote an article in the Naval Institute and said, hey, this is the coalition of the willing. Admiral Mullen always talked about the 1,000-ship Navy. Well, here's a great example of ships and navies working together to fight a world economic problem.
Admiral, what do you see as the effect of the presence of armed guards on a lot of merchant ships nowadays? Does it seems to deter piracy? Does it also pose the threat of an escalation of violence?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that a lot of people are dealing with right now. As of today, the facts are out there that any ship that has an armed security team on board has never been hijacked. So is that mean that the game is over? I don't think so, because I think there's a lot of questions left to be answered with these armed security teams. Okay, who controls them? I mean, let's say if you sail through the RRTC, you know, and there you see a fishing belt and start shooting at fishermen and kill fishermen, who is held liable? Is it the master? Is it the security team? Is it the state owned who owns the vessel? So there are a lot of issues left to be answered. They're great. I think that the merchants should take their responsibility, but I don't think that the final answer is the armed security teams. And the other thing that's about is there's a lot of logistical problems with getting weapons in there, and it's not cheap. It costs about $50,000 per transit to pay for these armed security teams. Some of the other issue that the MERS line will tell you is, hey, we don't need the armed security teams because we're going to go through there at 18 plus knots. So there are a lot of different variables, but I think it helps that they've had these security teams, but I don't think that's the final answer.
The Economist had an interesting article about a month ago where it talked about, and I alluded to it a little bit during the intro, and anybody who took Econ 101 in college knows that if you want more of something, then you provide an incentive and you reward it. If you want less of something, you increase the cost in order to do it, or you punish it. And one thing that the Economist mentioned is because of the ransoms, that it really has become an integral part of the economy there, that other layers are having a buy-in, so to speak. They may not be directly involved in piracy, but their interests become because they're tapping into that income stream and that influence stream. Are we reaching the point here that unless we substantially increase the cost to do that, and it becomes more and more of a part of that economy, that the problem with each year is going to be harder and harder to solve simply because of the economic interests that are more and more becoming involved in it.
Right. I mean, great question. I mean, one of the things about solving this problem in Somalia itself is that, you know, you're giving these people, you know, whatever it is, the pirates getting $2,000 or $3,000, whatever it is, $2,000 or $3,000 to a person whose you know, yearly income is, you know, probably, you know, maybe $500 or $600 is a lot of money. So A, you've got to, you know, how do you replace that and go in there and you know, say, okay, we're not going to let you be a pirate anymore, but you know, so we're going to take your income away. I mean, we've seen a lot of this, you know, these unemployed people in the Middle East. You know, what's happening there. The other part that we found doing research on my book is that everybody is involved with piracy. There you've got the boat dealers, you've got the car dealers, you have members of the government that are involved. Somebody is getting cut. And there are also people who are investing in piracy. They're putting up funds to whatever it is, to buy boats, buy arms, buy motors, or whatever, to pay these kids to go out there and be pirates, and they're getting a return on it. So you've got to replace that with something else in order to, you know, to say, okay, piracy is no good. There's a lot of, you know, talk from, you know, the people in Puntland that, hey, we're tired of the pirates. It gives us a bad name. But they really haven't put a lot of effort into it to stop it. So from the land part about it, it's just one of the issues that we're going to have to continue to deal with until we figure this out and somebody says, okay, we're going to go in there and, you know, whatever it is, develop, you know, Walmarts or whatever so that these people can go to work and provide income for their families.
Admiral, one of the things I've been critical of is the use of rather expensive U.S. Navy assets, multi-billion dollar cruisers and Aegis-equipped ships to fight pirates in a $100 boat with $1,000 worth of motors on it. Is the mix we have of ships out there the right mix? What kind of ships should we have to fight this sort of problem?
A great question, and one of the things that I talk about. I mean, to have an Aegis cruiser, you know, with the SH-60 helicopters and fast speed. I mean that is it's a great platform. But you're right. The public affairs guidance that was given to me when I was out there and said, yeah, it's an expensive warship, but you know, it can turn and do other things at a drop of a hat. I mean, my last flagship was the Boxer, which is an LHD, which is, you know, I had an aircraft carrier out there chasing pirates, and the Marines had all the fire and power in the world, you know, to go ashore and wipe out the pirate camps. But it was just overkill. The Swedes have sent their small patrol boats down there, which do a remarkable job. I mean, they're fast. They can go in close to shore. I mean, and you know, we've had frigates out there that have done it. I always brag about the Danish ship, their L class, which is the Absalon, which is a remarkable platform. I'm not one in favor with our new LCS. I think there's thousands of questions that are left to be answered on LCS. But if you look at what the Danes, and they've been out there, I think since 2008, basically they've had a ship out there of the Absalon class. There's two of them. They rotate them there. They send them out there for about a year, and it's just a perfect platform. It's about the size of an LCS. It can carry a helicopter. It's got a small well deck where they, you know, they can launch a craft and put their special forces out there. I mean, you're right. The ideal platform is LCS, but I mean, you know, does LCS have the legs, you know, to steam out there? You put that ship up at 45 knots, and you're going to have an oiler out there. So, I think that the other thing is, and we, you know, probably could talk about it, is, you know, the command and control. The U.S. Navy has basically been the flagship for the Combined Task Force 151. So you're going to need a pretty robust capability ship that has the C4, C3 to basically, you know, to talk to everybody else. And I don't think LCS has the size to be a command ship. So that's one of the restrictions. So until somebody else, you know, raises their hand to have the capability of a flagship, that, you know, has the communications capability, I think we're going to see continue to see DDGs and CGs out there. You know, there are some. The LPD-17 was my first flagship out there, San Antonio, which was a great platform. It's got a medical capability. It's got a helo deck, but you know, it's just a big ship, and it's not quite the platform you're out there. But I think that the LCS is the right size, but definitely it's going to have some limitation with the command and control.
I'll tell you what, Admiral, you're preaching my language here. One thing we've talked about here a few times, the Absalon is just a tremendous platform. You know, when you look at the question that LCS is supposed to be the answer to, I think that's the wrong answer. But I think the Absalon class, the Danes, they got a nice ship with some nice capability. And again, they did some trade-offs, but when you look at what you trade off going from 23 knots to 45 knots, it's really incredible. I also think the seven provinces and even the Norwegian Nansen class, you know, there's lots of trade-offs there that might be a little bit in the plus category. But before we jump down that rabbit hole, let me get my counsel myself on getting back on subject. When you discussed earlier, and you're the perfect person to kind of bring up a touchy subject here, when we're working with our allies, and you know, it's been called the Thousand Ship Navy, the Cooperative Maritime Partnership, and it's really nothing new in the history of our Navy or any Navy. You know, again, when you go back to the wars we had at the Barbary Pirates, we were allied with the Swedes, of all people, for I think a little more than a year and a half before they quit and went home back then. But one thing that on the ground side, anybody who's familiar with Afghanistan learns real fast, that a 1,000 Americans does not equal 1,000 Brits, does not equal 1,000 Spaniards or 1,000 Germans when it comes to what you can do with them because of caveats. And we've also have seen at sea that regardless of what the inherent capabilities of the platform might be, due to national caveats and restrictions, a commander really doesn't have full access to all the platforms that he has. And the question I had for you is that I understand the sensitivity of not wanting to, for lack of a better phrase, hurt somebody's feelings or to embarrass somebody on the public stage, and the very important aspects of being diplomatic about it. But there's a serious side to that, is you can talk to senior congressional staffers, whether you're talking about Afghanistan or also what's taking place in the Horn of Africa, who don't even know what caveats are or what impact that has. Have we done the right job on educating not just our political leaders, but also the American public on the reality of coalition warfare and what that gains for us or partially gains for us?
I mean, that's another great question, and the complexities of coalition warfare. I mean, for me, the good part about it is, you know, I flew out to Bahrain, was there for two or three days. Admiral Gortney said, you know, fly to Djibouti, get on the ship, and go to work. Now, if we would have gone in there and, okay, let's have a planning conference, you know, all this kind of stuff, we'd still be in the planning phases. We never would have got out there because, you know, everybody says, okay, I've got to do this, I've got to understand this, who's going to have this section, all that kind of stuff. So it's a very complicated thing. But I mean, an example is that, you know, when I got out there, there were only a few nations that actually wanted to apprehend the pirates. Some of, you know, a lot of navies will be out there and they'll say, we want to prevent a pirate attack, but we don't want to do anything with the pirates. And because, you know, I always say it's like the dog catching the car. And if you want to ask me the question about the legal ramifications, I could talk another hour about that, about the issues, what do you do with the pirates and how complicated it is to get the pirates from the Gulf of Aden to wherever. And I'll give you, not to jump the subject, but here's a great example is Absalon captured some pirates that were going after a Dutch ship. The Dutch said, okay, we will prosecute them. Okay, so now you're in the Gulf of Aden. You've got them on a Danish ship. How do you get them back to the Netherlands? Well, luckily for the Absalon, she went into Bahrain for a port call. So now you're telling the Bahrainians, okay, hey, we need to offload these suspected pirates, and okay, and Byron said, okay, you can offload them at night when the, and, you know, the night of when you're going to put them on a plane to fly them back to the Netherlands. Well, so they're staying out in the harbor, and they come in at night. They offload them, take them to the airport at Bahrain, load them on to whatever the flight number is, KLM flight 003, heading back to, you know, to Amsterdam. And of course they're walking on to their seats there, and the pilot says, "Who are these people?" And they say, "Well, they're suspected pirates." Well, what do you think the pilot said? "Not on my plane." So now they had to take them back off. Now it's all over the Bahrainian press about these pirates. And so then the Dutch had to send a military craft to come and get them. So it's very complicated. So, you mean, but we looked, the way I looked at it with the coalition, okay, what does each nation provide and what can they do? A lot of them have helicopters. They've got special forces out there, and they're very well trained. And so we just tried to put them in a niche where they would best fit. The other thing is the tactics that they do. The Chinese have been out there since 2009, and they what they're doing is convoy operations. We chose not to do convoy operations. We decided to put ourselves in boxes in the IRTC where most of the pirate activity was. So, you know, so it's just a different thing. But I think that overall everybody's working together. There's an event that it's held in Bahrain, and they hold it, I think, about every 6 months or called. It's SHADE, where they bring all the nations in together, and they've invited the Chinese. The Chinese have come to talk about issues like piracy and how we can work together. So there are a lot of intersecrecies from each nation, you know, things they want to do, how they want to, you know, operate their forces. But from my perspective, it has worked very well, and it's been a success story of the counter-piracy operation.
Well, let's talk about that success for a minute, because it seems an awful lot like squeezing a tube of toothpaste, that as we've put convoys in place in the IRTC and other efforts, the pirates have been very adaptive in expanding the way they operate by using motherships. Can you talk about that a little bit? How are we still behind the power curve on keeping up with what the pirates are doing?
Well, it's one thing. The reason why it's so difficult is the area itself. Okay, when I was commander of Task Force 151, my charter was the Gulf of Aden. The Gulf of Aden is three times the size of the Gulf of Mexico, and I had an average of about three ships, maybe at the most four. We had some P-3s. We would have Scan Eagle, you know, depending on the ship that came through there. So think about covering that area for pirates. I mean, it was a huge area. So, I mean, when we got out there, we knew that the pirates were going to adapt. I mean, they're not dumb. So what did they do? They shifted out to the Indian Ocean. I mean, the market, I mean, remember the Sirius Star, you know, this huge oil tanker that was headed for the United States, you know, that was hijacked out there way off the coast of Somalia. And, I mean, it's the vastness of the water is so big. They routinely have used motherships. I mean, a lot of times you'll see them just, you know, the six to eight of them, or maybe nine, will get in a skiff, you know, a couple skiffs go leave from Basasa and go up north and just hang out in the IRTC. But they're only good for 2 or 3 days. So what they have done is they've hijacked the Yemeni fishing vessels. Some of the vessels that they've actually pirated, they've used as motherships, and as we've just seen that, you know, the Iranians that the Stennis battle group just released, you know, was a typical example of a mothership, you know, large dhow that they're using to stay out there for extended periods of time. Not last year, I think it was in March, right off the coast of India, there was the Indian Navy attacked a large mothership that had over 60 pirates. So they have adapted to, you know, they know that they'll go where the less pain is and try to go after ships. I mean, the problem is even if we had the 1,000 ship Navy, there's so much ocean out there that we just could not, you know, go board every single vessel, every single dhow that's out there. I mean, there's thousands of them, and you know, and try to apprehend pirates. So it's I mean, there, you know, it's the is like when I talk to the shipping companies, you know, they say, hey, you know, it's there's going to be piracy. You know, no matter what you do, there's going to be piracy. I mean, you can see it, like you said, you know, in Indonesia, we're seeing it off in Nigeria right now. So I mean, whatever there's money to be made, there's going to be piracy.
Well, let's pull the thread on that on the size, because you're exactly right. We were talking about an absolutely huge body of water, but you know, going back to Navy planning 101 here, there's a certain logic to why the further you get away from something, the harder it becomes, because it's just a function of math. But we also know that where the ports are that they're coming out of, and one of the touchy subjects is, to use the politically correct parlance, creating effects ashore, that part of the solution, if you cannot defeat them way out in the Indian Ocean because of limited assets, and again, this is an ROE issue, but what does it take before we reach the point that with nobody has ever seriously discussed actually staying there for any length of time or even putting very many boots on the ground? But we know where the money is going and who it's going to, which clans it's going to, that many people say you're never going to really resolve the issue at sea, that you need to create effects ashore. And that's breaking things and probably ending a few lives and creating it financially difficult to the point that some clan leadership may decide that it's not in their interest to let this go on in the territory they control anymore. Are we going to reach that point, or are the political issues just too great to reach?
Well, in doing the research on my book, you know, I have asked this question to several people, and you know, where does the money go? And I think we've got a pretty good indication. But what I've found, you know that which is not good, is that the U.S. government and probably other governments have not put the resources in. I'm not talking about kinetic force. I'm talking about, you know, whatever, however we do it, to go after and say, okay, this is where the money is ending up, and go after that person. I mean, we've done a remarkable job after, you know, Al-Qaeda and you know, other terrorist organizations, but we have not gone after these people. I mean, there's a lot of people have said, okay, let's label them as terrorists, and then the rules change. I mean, it's criminal activity, and we've just not put the resources in there. I mean, the other thing about going kinetic and going ashore, I mean, I had a Marine colonel who now is a general. You know, every night when we'd sit down and talk about it, he'd say, Admiral, I can fix this problem in about 15 minutes. And he was right. I mean, just take a bunch of Cobra gunships and go in there and, you know, wipe out a bunch of, you know, fishing skiffs and knock some villages out. But I mean, you're going to go. I mean, pirates are like the way warfare is today. Is, you know, we're not fighting people with uniforms on. So are we? What's the world press going to say if we go in there and just wipe out, you know, a Herradera or some fishing village and take out innocent civilians? So I think it's just a very complicated issue. I mean, we've seen some cases. I mean, the French went after when they held some hostages, they went after the pirates. So I think there's just reluctance right now to put boots on the ground unless they were, you know, these people are going to be captured. The story, I mean, we would have, you know, what would have happened if Captain Phillips would have ended up in Somalia? And I've asked this question from State Department, MERS line, and everybody else. And the MERS people say we would have paid a ransom to get him back. The State Department said we would have persuaded them as hard as we can, or try to twist their arm not to do it. But the merchants are saying if we don't pay the ransom, you know, whether it's a civilian or boats, you know, we're not going to be able to get people to sail those waters. So if we're just going to let, you know, a master of a ship or a crew, you know, sit there for ages and ages, it's going to get hard to people. So the merchants are going to continue to pay the ransom. So somebody has got to make a decision in State Department, Treasury Department, and say, okay, we're going to go after the money, and we're going to find the kingpins, and then try to go after them and try to stop it.
A couple of years ago, at the Naval Institute, session on, we had conference on piracy, and one of the topics I brought up then was whether or not we should set up a containment system for the pirates by embargoing their shore. In other words, set up the ships, our ships, closer to their shore and not let anything, try and keep things from leaking out in the ocean so that in effect we shrink the ocean and not have to patrol the entire Gulf of Aden or the entire Indian Ocean, but really control the waters as close as we can to their pirate ports. What is the flaw in that logic, and how hard would that be to do?
Well, I've been out there at sea, and I've flown over the coast of Puntland and Bosassa, and you're talking a thousands and thousands of small craft, small boats. I mean, it's their livelihood. So it would be very complicated because, I mean, a couple things that are going on out there. One, they're pirates. Two, they may be fishing. Three, they're smuggling people, which is a huge business out there. About 50,000 people are leaving Somalia every year, going to Yemen in small boats. I mean, we see them all the time, at night especially, just crammed with hundreds, not hundreds, but lots and lots of people. And we couldn't stop it. We just make sure that they're safe to get to Yemen and let them go. And you know, thirdly, they're out there. That's what they call up off Yemen and Oman is the Hashish Highway. So they're smuggling drugs. So it would be complicated to go after and board each single vessel that's out there. I think if we showed a presence down there off the coast, if we had small vessels, like I said, the Swedes were down there working down there. If we showed presence, they may be reluctant, to go out there. But I think it would just be complicated because, I mean, the coastline is just huge, and it would be a very tough issue. And just getting the number of ships to do that would be really tough.
My next question, a little bit touchy, but I think it's important. Is because when you ask this, oftentimes depending upon the audience, it takes a while for people to sink in because it is an uncomfortable question. But when you have whether it's a few dozen or a few hundred people that are being held hostage, when you look at the nationality breakout of who's being held hostage, you have to ask the question: if it was 100 Americans, Brits, Canadians, and Dutch citizens being held hostage, as opposed to Bangladeshi, Filipino, Indian, or Syrians being held hostage, the reaction from the UN and the international community would be, I think is a pretty good bet, dramatically different. How much of that plays into it, and is it because that those nations that whose passports the hostages hold either aren't as concerned or just don't have the influence to raise it, say, if it was 100 Frenchmen?
Right. I mean, great question. I mean, look at the resources that we put there for Captain Phillips. I mean, one U.S. hostage, I mean, it was, remarkable. And like you said, if we had 10 or 15 American sailors, merchantmen that were, I'm sure we'd do the same resources. The problem is, you've got a vessel that's registered in Panama that belongs to X line. You've got a master that may be from Italy, let's say. Then you've got you've got Indians, you've got Pakistani, Filipinos, and so it's extremely complicated. They haven't raised the white flag. Is it just some of these countries? The Philippines, they just don't have the resources, and so they try to work through the agents to say, okay, let's. I mean, like I said, they're going to say, okay, we're going to negotiate. I mean, they're not going to. They want to try to bring the price down a little bit, but they will almost eventually they will pay the ransom. But it's so complicated when you have different factors and different nations that are in there. So I agree. I mean, if like you said, if a European nation or a Canadian ship got, I mean, I think piracy would be on the front page of the New York Times, and we'd go after it hard. It's just the fact that some of these people are just ones and twos from different nations, and they just don't have the firepower to go after them.
Yeah, I kind of want to revisit my embargo blockade concept for Somalia for a minute, because it's not – the ports that these guys are operating out of, for the most part, seem to be, I think, as you've already indicated, kind of in Puntland or northern Somaliland on the beaches there. During the Vietnam War, and I'm old enough to have participated in this, we had the market time operation where we took a fairly substantial coast of the Republic of Vietnam and provided ways to interdict vessels that were inbound or patrol that area. Is part of the problem now that we don't have the assets we had during the Vietnam War with a much larger Navy and a larger fleet and many more officers and men to go out and do it, or is it just that this problem is as you've already indicated, just too hard and too expensive in your view?
Well, no, I think one, I mean, you know, in Vietnam, you know, we had, you know, how many Riverine squadrons did we have? And we had, you know, a variety of ships to go after it. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but, you know, we had, I know we at least had twice as many ships as we do today, and the numbers are decreasing. I mean, every time, you know, we face another budget cut. So I think that's one thing. I mean, just from my personal opinion, I think that the U.S. Navy, I mean, they understand piracy. I think they look at it as a torn dollar bill. I mean, you know, we just can't get rid of it. We'd love for it to go away so we could shift some of these ships to other missions. And I think we're just going to put as little in the game as we possibly can. I don't think that, you know, it has reached to the magnitude of a national security issue where they're going to say, hey, we're going to go after and we're going to stop piracy. Because you're right. I mean, we know, I mean, Basasa is the pirate capital of the Gulf of Aden. I mean, I don't have the exact numbers, and I don't think any, but I would say that 85% of the people who are coming up there doing piracy are coming right out of Basasa, because it's a straight track north, and that's where, you know, they just leave there and just put their compass on north and just head up there, and, you know, a couple of days they're in the IRTC. So I just think, A, the navies are much smaller. I mean, how many warships do the Brits have now here in, you know, 2012? You know, in the 1980s when we were going to, you know, fight the Soviets when I first came in, you know, they had a grand fleet. You know, today they've just got, you know, you could fit them in, you know, one port now. So, I mean, it's just a remarkable decline in the size of the navies. And I just think that people are, I mean, they're going to be out there. And they're going to do, you know, just some functionality of piracy. The nation, I tell you, that everybody should worry about out there is China. I always ask the question, you know, what, you know, why are the Chinese out there? I mean, they have a huge merchant fleet, so they're there to protect them. But when I was out there in 2009, when the Chinese came over to visit me on the Boxer, you know, they saw all our weapon systems, and, you know, they could ask me a million questions, but the question they keep asking about was logistics. Okay, how do you refuel? How do you do this? How do you do that? And it was all centered around logistics. They didn't really care on, you know, what type of bombs the AV-8s carried or what type of weapon systems, you know, were on some of the things. They just wanted to talk about logistics. So, yeah, I think the people you need to watch out for out there is the Chinese.
Well, Admiral, that's a perfect lead-in. As a matter of fact, you stole part of my question, but I'm going to run with it anyway. And what you said at the end exactly parallels. I recently talked to an officer who did the classic dog and pony show with his Chinese counterpart, and they're sitting there up on the bridge, and that is the question, commander to commander, that was taking place. Did not give a flying you-know-what about anything. He wanted to talk about logistics. You know, you talk about from a shrinking Navy to a growing Navy. And piracy, in a way, I think, has brought an opportunity for China to do something that it really hasn't done in a few hundred years, and that's a sustained out-of-area deployment. And when he was discussing with me about all the logistics questions, it just kind of pimped in my mind that their response to piracy, was this something that they're doing because they now have the capability to do, or did they decide that they needed to do counter piracy and as a result decided to give more resources or, you know, make it a more sustained effort and desire to do it, you know, chicken or egg routine. You know, part of me thinks that they're just going out there and doing it because they can. But if I was a Chinese naval officer who was trying to increase the influence and funding for my branch, I would make that sell about, hey, this is an opportunity for us to get out there and work with all these other navies, and we're going to do what the Chinese do best. We're going to put out a net, and we're going to sweep up all these best practices, and we're going to bring them back, and we're going to make ourselves a better Navy. Is that really what they're doing? Not so much anti-piracy, but going out there and learning best practices?
I think all of the above. I mean, like you said, you know, piracy was a I mean, I don't know who actually decided, but they said, okay, this is the marker. We can go out there. The Chinese people will support us, and the world will support us because we've got this huge merchant fleet, you know, of Chinese, you know, flag vessels that we need to protect. So they go out there. But then now you just look at the tentacles. I mean, they made a trip into the Gulf. They, you know, they made a port visit in there. They're establishing ports. They've talked about, you know, ports in the Seychelles. Okay, they're talking about ports in Pakistan. You know, go back there and look when Libya started. You know, last year, the Chinese had a warship there before the United States had a warship there to evacuate citizens. I mean, think about that. You know, you and I have been around a long time, and we have had, you know, Marine Expeditionary, you know, task force that have been in the Mediterranean, you know, and one of their core missions is NEO. I mean, I've spent, a large percentage of my time, you know, working with the Marines and on amphibs. I mean, and that was, we always practiced that NEO. The Chinese were there before the U.S. could get there. So I just, you know, last year they had their hospital ship in the Caribbean, and, you know, the Chinese label it as, you know, we've always had friends in the Caribbean. Okay. That for me was hard to connect the dots. You know, the Chinese in the Caribbean. I mean, the Dutch and the UK and everybody else has been there for a year. These were their old colonies, but I don't, you know, remember, you know, much. My history didn't recall much when the Chinese had a lot of relations in the Caribbean. So they are spreading their tentacles. I mean, when you look at the percentage of what oil comes out, you know, out of the Middle East for China, I mean, it's remarkable. Sudan, you know, Iran, you know, and they're working with the Saudis now. So, I mean, their numbers are going to continue to increase. You know, 30 years ago, you know, everybody in China was riding a bicycle. Then they had a moped, and now that, you know, they're buying cars and 787s. So this huge economy is going to continue to boom. And somebody's got to feed those resources. I mean, they're not going to drive cars with coal. So they've got to get the oil somewhere, and the majority of it is right there in the Middle East. So they, yes, all of the above. They're out there piracy, and they're out there extending their tentacles.
Well, speaking of spreading the piracy, Robert Kaplan, in his book Monsoon, talked about the importance of the Indian Ocean, and one of the factors that I'm kind of amazed is the Indians have been very involved in fighting piracy off their own coast, but seemingly more reluctant to assert greater control over the, not greater control, but greater influence over the Indian Ocean than I would have thought they would do. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they actually have been out there. They were out when I was out there. We had some Indian officers actually visit me on one of the ships. So they have escorted some of their ships. I would have to do some little research. They have not really joined up, you know, with any particular task force. They're kind of out there on their own. But they've been very aggressive out, you know, they're in their territorial waters. If the pirates come out there, you know, you better beware, because if they find them, they're going after them, and they're very aggressive after them. We had one case, and I remember it well, that we had to, there was an Indian ship, flagship that was being pirated, and the Indians got there, and they were firing. I mean, they went after them, and we actually had a UK Hilo that was out there. I mean, right there at the same time, and the captain of the UK ship called me up and said, "Hey, I've got to back my helo out of there because somebody's going to get hurt." So they are very aggressive when they're out there going after pirates. I mean, I would say as aggressive as any nation out there. So, I mean, if you're a pirate, and actually the pirates know that, and there has been, you know, one of the things that I always talk about when we talk to the pirates, I don't want to say interrogated them, you know, we don't want to do that, but when we talk to the pirates that we captured, they... You know, there's some things that, you know, I guess now it doesn't make any difference. We had discussions with them. They mentioned that there's a pirate code where they actually don't want to, you know, they don't want to hurt anybody. They don't want to damage the ships. But there has been, you know, since a couple pirates were killed, you know, last year when the Indian Navy went after them, I think the pirates would really and truly like to save their brothers and go after some Indian merchants or, you know, some people in the Indian Navy. But of all the nations that are out there, when I was out there, the Indian Navy was probably the most aggressive.
Yeah, I think in addition to the Indians, because I've heard the same thing about the Indians. You just plain don't want to mess with them. I guess they figure, you'll be reincarnated. Don't worry about it. But that and the Russians, no, I don't think you want to mess with the Russians too much either. Going back to kind of Vince Lombardi academics here, you know, in C2-101, there's a little concept called unity of command. And early on, you know, you mentioned this whole constellation of different task forces out there. And we've all seen different variations of the lack of a better phrase, of the water space management that goes on there between the EU task force, NATO's task force that's gone out there,
right.
CTF 150, 151, and then you have kind of the independent operators that'll go out there two or three ships at a time. And what's lacking there is that critical fundamental of unity of command. And in spite of the UN mandate and all the other things that are going on there, is there any progress towards getting some better unity of command so we can do better as an international community, what we have out there? Because from the cheap seats, it almost seems as if, I can't see whether it's getting better or worse, but we are just kind of stuck in a rut here that we really aren't making any progress towards getting a little bit better unity of command. Have we seen any improvement there, or is it just not going to happen?
I think the answer is yes, we have seen improvement, but I think it's little steps. It's not major steps. I mean, it would, you know, like, you know, the other problem that you have, you know, when we talk about, you know, neighbors living, you know, close to each other, you know, you have certain, you know, when you have a NATO task force out there, I mean, the EU, the European Union task force was the first out there. It was commanded by the Greeks. Okay, so now you have another maritime nation that's very close to them that wants to get out there too. So you still got some neighborhood and some old, you know, anxiety of things that, you know, about working with task force and who, you know, who's the best people, you know, and we could talk about this over a beer rather than, you know, on open net. But I mean, it's just that it's hard. I mean, when I was out there, I mean, here we are, we were steaming around, the NATO task force came out there and they wanted to take over. And, you know, I met with their staff and I said, "Hey, look," I said, "we've been out here for 4 months." I said, "Okay, this is, you can do whatever you want, but this is where we're going to patrol." And I mean, and all the ships in my task force at that time were all NATO ships. So, I mean, it's just, you know, there's still just some problems, you know, and, you know, who's the biggest stick on the block. And but like I said, Fifth Fleet has hosted this SHADE conference, and we invite everybody to come and talk about it and problems. My biggest concern when I got out there was deconfliction with everybody flying, you know, helicopters on different frequencies, because the last thing I wanted to do is have, you know, two helicopters from different task force, you know, running each other. So we came up with ways that, you know, with message traffic and, you know, to get to, okay, here's our flight ban, here's our plan for the next 5 days. I mean, it's not national security secrets, you know, we're fighting pirates. So, you know, the best ways that we could get this information out there. And which, you know, the other problem with is, you know, I the United States Navy is far and above you know, a tier one Navy. And then some of these other ships send their best platforms out there, but they're, you know, in their C3 is not as capable as what the U.S. Navy have. So it sometimes it's a little hard to communicate with them. But we, you know, deconfliction, you know, with ships, helicopters, and, you know, things were going, it was one of my number one priorities when we were out there.
So, Admiral, you've got a book coming out. Could you talk a little bit about that and talk about what you're up to these days?
Okay, retired from the Navy about 2 years ago, and I always tell the story. I had a Marine major guy named Tim Watkins, who was just a brilliant guy on my staff, and I was sitting there at a meeting one night, and I asked him. I said, "Hey, could you just build me a Rotary Club brief? You know, talk about piracy, so I could, you know, talk to whatever Naval Institute or, you know, CNA." And actually, I thought it, you know, the gig would only last for a couple of months, and it still goes on. I still get invited to a lot of things, and still use the information that they provided me. And had a lot of people. And my wife, she heard me speak a couple times, and some other people come up and say, "Hey, why don't you write a book?" And one guy said to me one time, he said, "Why don't you write a book?" I know what the title could be, and of course, you know what he said, "Terry and the Pirates," which would already been used. So I went out on a limb and said, in 2011, I'm gonna get started on a book, and so we're working on it. I had a great agent, Doug Grad, who helped me get through the wickets, and I've got a guy named Michael Hirsch who's just a remarkable guy and has written a couple books on the military, one about the Air Force Para Rescue, and he had, his latest book was The Liberators, the army that liberated the concentration camp. So a lot of experience, and so we're off and running. The Naval Institute Press is going to publish the book, and they want the final draft here in the middle of May. So we're working hard on it right now. It's going to be called Pirate Alley, and I hope, not sure how it's going to take, but I hope you can have yourself a Christmas present next year under the tree with about pirates.
Well, it's funny. A couple people I know are in the process of writing books, and one of them is really meticulous and has everything lined up, and the other one is says, "I work best under panic, so I'll just wait to the last minute." So whichever way works best for you, Admiral, I hope it works out well for you. And speaking of which, while we're coming up towards the end, as somebody who works in a lower part of the ecosystem, but I like to keep my finger on the pulse of how, you know, piracy is developing, whether we're talking about Gulf of Aden, Indonesia, West Africa, as we are right now. If there are a few things that I wanted to put, or somebody else, one of our listeners, wanted to put in their, you know, Google search, automatic notification, or just wanted to keep in the background looking for, what are some key places or names that people should be focused on if they want to keep the track of the latest developments?
Well, it's a great point. There's two guys that I talk to all the time and who are really the A-team on piracy. It's a guy named Dr. Martin Murphy, great guy. I see him all the time, talk to him. He's Brit by nationality, but has really got a handle on piracy. Another is Dr. Peter Pham, PHAM, who these two guys probably know more about piracy, you know, in Somalia. Never, you know, haven't spent time out to sea, but two great guys that really are well versed in piracy. And if I have a question on piracy or about Somalia, I go directly to them. There are two other people that I recommend. A guy named Steve Caldwell. He's at the Government Accounting Office, who watches maritime security for the government, and a vast amount of experience about the piracy and the history of piracy. Another guy who, from a legal perspective, James Kraska. He's up at the War College right now. He's a commander in the Navy. From the legal perspective, just a wealth of information. So there, I mean, it has been amazing people who have come out the woodwork, I'd say, and who have helped us with this book and we've talked to. And I mean, just there's a lot of people who like maritime security. There's people at Maersk Line that I've talked to, Gordon Van Hook, who's a retired Navy captain, really great to talk to about piracy and talking, you know, he spent, you know, a career in the U.S. Navy and now he's in, you know, working for the Merchant. So he has seen both perspectives and has a real good perspective on piracy. So that's a quick list of people, but I've got a bunch more if you ever need them.
And of course, you can always go over to Eagle Speaks. Yeah, always a good place.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you very much, Admiral, for taking time again this afternoon on Sunday to come with us and talk about piracy. And I wish you the best of luck with your book.
Okay, great. And it's been great talking to you. And you know, maybe 6-8 months or so, we can get back together. Or anytime you have a question, don't hesitate to send me an email or give me a call.
Great. We look forward to it.
Free copies of the book, Admiral.
I'm not going to make any money. I'm not going to make anything off this book because everybody wants a free copy. But I just want to see it one day, and I'll be glad to sign it and give out free copies. It's a real pleasure working with y'all, and just to give, you know, to see somebody read it, it'd be great.
Yeah, have a great week, and for everybody who's joined us, thank you very much. Catch us next week for another edition of Midrats. Hope you have a great Navy Day.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.